The Eagles' Desperado was the song that Sir Owen had wanted to be played at his funeral. "Oh, this is going to be a tearjerker," he always said when it came on the radio. "Oh boy, this is going to be a doozy. I don't know how you're going to make it through this, Jill. Oh man, oh man, oh man, you'll be a puddle on the floor."
"You'll be a puddle on the floor in a minute," she responded. Or, "Don't talk about your funeral, it's bad taste." Or, "Stop it, Owen, it wasn't funny the first time." Or, "I told you I don't like to think about that." Or, "I won't have time to cry, I'll be too busy snogging my new boyfriend." Or, "Owen, will you just shut up for once and let me hear the bloody song?"
But he'd been right. She cried from the first chord. She cried from the first melancholy lyrics, and she cried at the way the background strings swelled up to meet the piano. And she cried when the drums came in. The screen beside the casket lit up with cross-dissolving shots of him, as a boy, as a teenager, as a young man, on their wedding day, with each of their children at the hospital, guiding first steps, blowing out candles, giving horse rides on his hands and knees, asleep in bed one lazy morning, wearing a paper crown on Christmas Day, and on through the years, as his chest broadened and his shoulders thickened and his hair turned grey, saluting from the driver's seat of a convertible, digging a hole for a fence post, hunting with her father, showing off a pig on a rotisserie, grinning by a waterfall, giving away Rachel at her wedding, dancing Gangnam style. The final shots were crisper and held on a little longer than the rest. The photo of the two of them that had been published in the Thorndike Times when he'd first received the news about the knighthood, after which, she'd remembered, he'd picked her up, laughing in a fireman's lift, and carried her inside and straight to bed. And then, finally, an official portrait from the day of his investiture. Just him alone, all scrubbed and sashed and starred and suited up and looking fit to burst with pride. This image held on a little longer after Desperado reached its end, as a shifting silence filled the room, and Lady Darvish wiped her eyes and blew her nose and heard Sir Owen's voice.
"Now that's how you end a song," he said, or would have said, or used to say. "None of this fade-out crap. None of this just turn down the volume and let's call it a day kind of carry-on. That is a song, Jill, that knows when it is done."
The wake was held at the Molloys. Mark was waiting with a glass of Chardonnay, but when Lady Darvish excused herself to go and freshen up, she poured it down the drain and refilled the glass with tap water instead. She drank it without breaking eye contact with her reflection, and then refilled the glass and drank that too, and then refilled it a third time and poured it out again for no good reason. A habit that had used to drive Sir Owen mad. And then she sat down on the toilet seat and breathed and thought about Lemoyne and Burnham Wood. Her thoughts went round and round. Kathy tapped her fingernails against the door and whispered, "Jill, sweetie." And all at once she heard Sir Owen in her head again.
"That is a song, Jill, that knows when it is done."
She would know when this was done, she thought. This wasn't done. She wasn't done. She, Jill Darvish, devoted wife of Owen Darvish, mother of his children, was not done.
"One minute,"
she called through the door. She took out her phone and opened the Air New Zealand app and searched for a flight to Christchurch. There was one that left Wellington at 9:05. She booked a seat without a bag and paid for it, and then went back into the living room and did the rounds, thanking everyone for coming, accepting hugs and clutching hands, and agreeing that Sir Owen would have been so happy with his send-off, agreeing it was all so shocking, so abrupt, so unbelievable, so sad, agreeing that he was a wonderful man and a wonderful father, agreeing that her life would never be the same. Kathy had made her up a plate of finger food, and she ate purely so that nobody could tell her they were worried that she wasn't eating. And then she gathered up her kids and held their hands and told them all she was exhausted. She had barely slept all week, she said, and it was finally catching up with her, now that she'd made it through the funeral and reality was hitting home. They'd each offered to come back to the flat with her, just to stay a while, just to keep her company, just so there'd be someone in the house when she woke up. It had been very sweet of them to offer, she said, but the sooner she got into a normal routine, the better. And really, all she needed now was sleep. Jessie and his girlfriend drove her home. She hugged them both and said goodnight and went inside the flat and shut the door and waited 30 seconds and then called a taxi to come and take her to the airport right away. In Christchurch, she hired a rental car and set off south. But she had barely left the airport car park when she began to cry again,
and soon her vision was so blurred by tears that she had to pull over and hug the steering wheel and sob. It was past 11. She cried until her eyes were swollen shut. And then she sat with her forehead pressed against her folded arms above the horn and told herself that she was exhausted, that it was true she hadn't slept all week, that she was really in no fit state to drive, least of all a 5-hour trip to Thorndyke in the middle of the night. The last thing her children needed was to lose both their parents in the space of a week. Chastened, she went to a motel instead and let the night clerk draw his own conclusions from her puffy face and the lateness of the hour, and the fact that she was carrying no luggage, not even a handbag, just her phone and her keys and her driver's license and a credit card. She paid for the room in advance, let herself in, got under the synthetic comforter and slept. It was still quite dark when she woke, but even so, she stared at the digital clock on the bedside table without comprehension for almost a minute, trying to figure out if it was 4:15 in the morning or 4:15 in the afternoon. Both seemed equally implausible, as did the bed that she was lying in, and the flat-screen television mounted on the wall, and the darkened window, and the plastic kettle, and the shiny comforter, and everything else in the room. But at last she managed to locate herself in space and time, and with great effort she clambered out of bed, left the room, put the key through the slot of the after-hours checkout box, and got back into the car. "What is it that you think you're going to find down there exactly?" she'd said to Sir Owen, when he'd so uncharacteristically gone behind her back to book his flight.
"If I knew that," he'd replied curtly, "I wouldn't be going down, would I?"
Lady Darvish replayed the conversation in her head as she drove. "Owen," she had said, pressing him, "I told you, Anthony probably just made a mistake."
"Yes," he had shot back, "I heard you."
She thought about the fact that Anthony had not returned her call. She'd left a message on his answer phone a week ago, and he had never called her back. Why not? In his email to Sir Owen, he had said explicitly that he was writing an article about Lemoyne. So why would he not have called her back? She knew as much as her husband knew. She was a source as much as he was. She was a party to the land sale just as he was. In fact, she was now the only party to it. And Sir Owen's death had not exactly been a secret. It had been broadcast and published in the news. So why would Anthony not want to speak to her? It made no sense. Lady Darvish felt her thoughts returning to a furrow. Why had Sir Owen driven out to the lookout after dark? Had he really been in talks to fund a not-for-profit? And why had he never mentioned Burnham Wood to her, not once? Dawn broke as she left the coast and headed inland, feeling, as she always did the closer she got to Thorndyke, a deep sense of rightness, of things existing in their proper places, in their proper order, for all time. She drove on, past the shuttered shops along the highway frontage, past the petrol station, past the edge of town to the bottom corner of what was now Lemoyne's property, and along the fence to what was now their shared front gate. She could see the vast mound of gravel in the lower fields that she and Owen had intended for the new road that would have fed onto the subdivision before the landslide caused the closure of the pass, before they'd met Lemoyne, before he'd made his offer. Glancing over at it, she was surprised to see a great many heavy vehicles clustered in the field around it. Cement mixers, 18-wheelers, mobile offices, RVs. Surely Lemoyne could not have started work so rapidly, Lady Darvish thought, frowning, slowing down and craning for a better look. He'd need planning permission, obviously, and that process would take months or even years. What was going on? Did the construction site have to do with Burnham Wood somehow? She had reached the front gate. She was about to pull in, but at the last moment she changed her mind and decided to keep driving, up to the unsealed service road that ran up the southern fence. It was a Saturday, and Lemoyne had told her on the phone that he wasn't staying at the farm right now. But even so, some instinct told her to be cautious. When she reached the farm gate at the top of the hill, she got out to unlock the padlock and wind the chain around the fence post, and saw that there were deep tire tracks in the mud, running up the hill and out of sight. In her head, she heard Sir Owen's voice again.
"It's that Anthony specifically said the word radiometric," she heard him say. "That's what doesn't make sense. There wouldn't be an on-the-ground testing site for that, because nowadays they do it all from the air. They use high-flying drones. That's what I'm telling you."
She pushed the gate open, trapping it behind a tuft of grass to stop it swinging shut again, and then got back in the car and drove through. On the other side, she stopped again and got out again to shut and lock the gate behind her, taking her phone out of her pocket to check the time. but the battery was dead. She got back in the driver's seat and looked at the clock on the dash. It was coming on to 9:30. Her children would probably be calling the flat in Wellington pretty soon to see how she was doing. They'd panic if they couldn't reach her. They might be panicking already. She hated the thought of having to explain to them where she was, and what she was looking for, and why. Maybe when she got to the house, she thought, she'd send an email to all three of them at once. She put the car in gear and drove on, off-roading down through the fields below the shelter belt, and cutting a wide arc to avoid the seam of limestone that formed a kind of shallow cliff above the house. As she came back around across the hill, she got another view of the heavy vehicles clustered by the mound of gravel in the field below. She stopped and shaded her eyes to see if she could spot anybody moving, but the site appeared to be deserted. She drove on, parked beside the back porch, collected her phone from the cup holder between the two front seats, and let herself in the back door.
Robert!
She called out, just in case. But the house was still. Coming down the hall, she knew at once that something was wrong. The front door was standing open. And when she came through into the kitchen, she found the glass jug from the coffee maker smashed across the floor. One of the dining chairs was lying on its back. Looking down at it, she saw that the middle section of a jagged splash of coffee had been disturbed. Something, or someone, had been dragged through it and towards the door. Lady Darvish stood very still, looking around her, listening hard. And then she went quickly to the hall table and picked up the landline. It was dead. Adrenalized, she ran on quiet feet down the hall to the garage, fearing that she was going to find the gun cabinet looted, the door pried open, the rack of rifles gone. But it was shut and locked as always. She went across to open it and reassure herself that the guns were all accounted for, before she realized that, of course, Sir Owen had the key. It was up in the flat in Wellington, his key ring having been returned to her after it was found on his body following the crash. She turned on the spot, feeling lightheaded, feeling electric, feeling weirdly potent and alive. And then she saw that something else was missing. The plastic drum marked dangerous poison and sodium fluoroacetate, and restricted chemical product, and 1080 bait for the control of rabbits, with an authorizing label made out to Mr. Owen Darvish of Darvish Pest Control. She heard a scream. It was distant. She guessed it issued from the fields below the house, but it was unmistakably a scream of pain, an abject, full-throated, terror-stricken cry for help. It sounded like a girl. Lady Darvish felt her heart constricting in her chest. She couldn't move. She waited for the ghastly sound to stop, and eventually it did, but only long enough for the girl to draw another breath, and then she screamed again. Lady Darvish ran down the hall to what they'd always referred to as the front room, even though it was strictly speaking on the side of the house and not at the front. It had been the living room before they'd built the extension and put in the picture window, and since the renovation, they had hardly used it. On a low bookshelf against the wall was the special presentation case that she'd made for Sir Owen's 50th birthday, where his 22 air rifle and his skinning knife were displayed on velvet behind museum glass. She opened the case and took out the rifle, jamming the stock against her hip, gripping it just beyond the trigger guard with her left hand, and with her right, smacking it to break the barrel open. She pulled the barrel down until she heard a click, looked down the length of it to make sure that it was clean, and then hooked it over her arm and scrabbled for the tin of pellets that Sir Owen kept in the top drawer of the desk. She opened the tin, selected a pellet, inspected it for imperfections, then slipped it headfirst into the breech and snapped the barrel shut again. She shoved the tin into her pocket and was about to leave the room when she thought better of it and grabbed the skinning knife as well. The same instinct that had warned her not to drive onto the property through the front gate told her to leave the rental car behind the house, where she had parked it, and proceed quietly on foot. She shoved the skinning knife into her back pocket, put the rifle stock against her shoulder, and ran in the direction of the sound, stepping lightly, scanning the fields around her as she ran. All the doubt that she had suffered over Burnham Wood had left her. All her grief had left her. All the confusion and second-guessing doubt that had brought her to the farm was gone. Someone was in trouble. Someone needed to be saved. She felt as she had in the last stage of childbirth, animal and yet primordial, emptied out and yet invincible, unstoppable, incredible, alive. She came over the crest of the hill. Lemoyne was standing with his back to her, one hand in his pocket, scrolling through something on his phone. The person who was screaming was on the ground in front of him. It was not a girl, but a young man,
A hippie type, Lady Darvish thought, bizarrely, with a beard and tangled hair. His left hand was bandaged. His right was bound at the wrist to a young woman whose other hand was bound to the chassis of a truck. Lady Darvish watched in horror as the young man tugged desperately at the tie that bound them, stretching the woman's arms out as far as they could go. Her head was slumped forward, and there was vomit down her front. She was dead, or at the very least unconscious. The young man was still screaming. Horrified, Lady Darvish tore her gaze away, seeing more bodies, more vomit, all young people, all dead, fanned out across the site and contorted where they lay, as if they had discovered all at once that they'd been poisoned and had tried, too late, to run. Lady Darvish felt her vision start to blur. She saw that the vehicles had been defaced with slogans, the sloppy letters trailing rivulets of paint. She saw the words, "This is your future," and she saw the word "justice," and she saw the word "shame." The young man stopped screaming. He had seen her. Lemoyne glanced up from his phone, alerted by the change. He saw where the young man was looking, followed the direction of his gaze, and turned around. Lady Darvish said nothing. She advanced towards Lemoyne, holding the rifle level, breathing through her mouth, lifting her knees high and rolling each step from the heel to the toe like she'd been taught. And as she drew nearer, she felt, suddenly, a transcendent sense of calm. Lemoyne had killed her husband. Lemoyne had done it. Lemoyne was capable of evil. Now she knew. And she had always known. That was the sad thing. Neither she nor Owen had ever been under any illusions that Lemoyne was a good person, Lady Darvish thought, as she advanced. They'd known that he was bad right from the start. And still they'd courted his business. Still they'd courted his approval, his respect. Still they'd courted him. Her thoughts alighted on a scene from her early 20s, when she and Owen had first been going round together. He'd given her a lamb that wouldn't suckle, and she'd raised it on a bottle and kept it as a pet for a few months, and then they'd killed and butchered it together. He'd given her the stunner. "Right in the middle of the forehead," he had murmured, standing a few steps behind her with a boning knife concealed behind his back, ready to slit the lamb's throat as soon as the animal went down. "Don't spook him. You can take your time. Wait until he turns to look at you, and then imagine there's an X in the middle of his forehead. And shoot for the middle of the X." She was still advancing. Very slowly, Lemoyne put up both his hands, extending one arm and dropping his phone into the dirt, throwing it away from his body, as if he were giving up a gun. "Breathe out before you shoot," Lady Darvish heard Sir Owen say. "At the bottom of the breath, you're steadier than at the top. You're doing fine, Jill. Just wait for him to look at you. Then breathe." Lemoyne was looking at her. She breathed. She visualized an X in the middle of his forehead. And then she shot him right between the eyes. The report echoed in the hills around them. Lady Darvish barely heard it. She drew Sir Owen's skinning knife out of its sheath and ran forward with it to cut the cable tie that bound the dead girl and the boy. "Is there anybody else?" she said as she sorted it, and the plastic snapped and he was free. "Is there anybody else alive?" But he was already scrambling away from her, crying, rasping, hobbling away. "Wait," she said, reaching for him. "Wait, is there anybody else here?" He was running now. "The driver," he said, his voice cracking. "Behind you." And she was already half turning when she caught a spray of bullets in her back.